Hi, I'm Eddie Grant, and you're listening to Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the 31st of August 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch. I'm your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. And we are broadcasting live from the Sheffield Live radio studio in the centre of Sheffield. Whether you're listening on FM radio or online, our show is also available as a podcast later on from the Sheffield Live website, sheffieldlive.org. Now, talking podcasts, normally now I'd flag up last Friday's programme, but I was away camping last Friday on the Gower Peninsula in Wales. It was brilliant. It only rained a little bit, but we had loads and loads of fun. Have you been away yet? Have you taken a break from your business or social enterprise? What have you been up to? Have you got that back to school feeling as September approaches? Are you looking forward to an exciting autumn of getting on with cracking your business social enterprise goals? And do you want to tell me all about it? Because I'm looking for really interesting guests to come on the programme and talk about their business or social enterprise. We've got some fabulous, fascinating people lined up throughout September and even into October too. But if you want to put yourself forward to be on the show, then do get in touch, because it would be great to hear from you. I'll give out contact details in a moment or two. But before I do that, who's on today? What's coming up? Well, it was fascinating to talk with Jonathan Cook of Principle 5 earlier on this week. And Principle 5 supports co-ops in Sheffield. And Jonathan also works for a co-op, a tech co-op. He told me all about how cooperatives work, their ethos, the values, the principles behind them, and what Principle 5 actually does. And we'll hear from Jonathan in a moment or two. Just before we do that, a couple of events coming up that look really interesting. On the 19th of September, there's a crowdfunding workshop organised by Sheffield Social Enterprise Network with Crowdfund 360. And this is a two-hour workshop aimed at social entrepreneurs and social impact businesses who may be curious about running a crowdfunding campaign. And when done right, crowdfunding can bring new customers, investment opportunities, access to grant funding, PR, and of course, can increase your sales. That's at the Diamond, the University of Sheffield building, on the 19th of September, 9 a.m. through to 11 a.m. The details are on eventbrite.co.uk. I will tweet the details of that event from my Twitter account, Jamie Veitch. Now, also coming up, and I'm afraid also on the 19th of September, there is a VAT breakthrough event, and that is at Union Street, the co-working space in the centre of the city, and it's for businesses that are looking to potentially to register for VAT and to break through the VAT barrier. There's also an event not only on the 19th of September, there's one on the 24th of October and the 4th of December. Again, I'll tweet the details to that too. And then finally, I wanted to flag up Don Catchment Rivers Trust. They're running something on the 11th of September, the Living Heritage of the River Don Project on the 11th and 12th of September. Fascinating in terms of what's been going on with the Don. I'll tweet the link to that too. But if you want to get in touch, if you want to put yourself forward to be on the show, comment on anything we talk about, then get in contact with me. Email jamie@sheffieldlive.org. Send a text 07904 272 200. Find me, Jamie Veitch, on Twitter. And of course, Sheffield Live is on Twitter as well. Now, without further ado, we're going to hear all about co-ops. I found it fascinating speaking with Jonathan Cook earlier on this week, picking his brains. I hope you find it interesting too. We'll hear from Jonathan now. So, hi, Jonathan. Thanks so much for joining me today. Can you just introduce yourself? What do you do? What's Principle 5?
Right, I'm Jonathan Cook, and I try to help encourage cooperatives and cooperative activity around Sheffield. I've done so since particularly joining Principle 5. So this is an organisation, a cooperative dedicated to support other cooperatives and encourage people to join them through education.
OK, grand. And Sheffield has a
thriving cooperative sector. It seems to me there are some well-known cooperatives, WeGather, for example, and others too. Perhaps you can describe some of the cooperatives in the city that we will have heard of, and name some other cooperatives here in Sheffield that we might not have heard of.
Yeah, absolutely. The Sheffield cooperatives, there's probably something around 20 or more that are just Sheffield-based alone. They're all listed on a website called sheffield.coop, C-O-O-P,
yeah.
With some explanation and the links. You mentioned ReGather, for example. That's one of an interesting new type of organisation. I like to think it's a little bit beyond the traditional social enterprise where there might be one particular aim, social aim or productive aim. With organisations like ReGather, the aims can be wide-ranging and develop as time goes on. Of course, this happens a little bit with any organisation. They change a little bit. But ReGather has branched out in so many ways, from veg box schemes to brewing beer,
yes,
to running a venue. And I remember when ReGather set up, it had a slightly different vision then. I think they were trying to just bring independently working people together to continue working independently, but cooperate as a cooperative of workers.
Yes.
And of course, this type of model that is much more experimental is obviously very interesting. And we've got examples in Sheffield such as Union Street,
yeah,
which has started out as a co-working space. So it is that sort of facility for independent workers to share a bit of social space and workspace. But they're experimenting also with things like the food outlet at the front and the venue and so on.
So Union Street, grand. Union Street co-working space, a space I love. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's another good example is Portland Works, which is a huge renovated factory entirely owned by a large collective cooperative of members. And each unit within it, I believe, is separately used by some of the members of that that co-op as spaces for reviving old Sheffield trades or furthering new
yeah,
crafts.
And Portland Works was saved thanks to a community share issue and is set up as a society for community benefit, I understand, as well. Mm-hmm. So would you define places like the Gardener's Rest, which had a community share issue to save the pub and is now owned as a community benefit society, would you call that a cooperative? Or
Yes, I would. Within British law, there's a huge range of types of organisation which can also be called cooperatives, and they don't necessarily have cooperative in the title or
yeah,
in the constitution, but they are nevertheless co-ops. So, the Gardener's Rest is a great example. What better thing to share among the community than the ownership of the place where everyone goes for a pint?
Yeah, a lovely pint as well, and rather fine sandwiches, as I discovered the other night after a trip out rock climbing and in need of refreshment, popped into the Gardener's Rest and pie and pint, very good.
Great.
Okay, so we talked about a few examples of cooperatives, and
yep,
I think that's a really important point that you made there, Jonathan, that, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to have a cooperative in the name to be a cooperative in law. This is about structures, about legal structures, and philosophy and way of doing business as well. But you mentioned at the start of the interview that Principle 5 then is a cooperative itself and exists to support cooperatives. So how do you support cooperatives? What do you do to support them?
Right, before I go into the details of what Principle 5 does, it might be interesting to say what unites all the co-ops, as I've said, not necessarily called that.
Yes.
And there's a set of values called the cooperative principles. There are five of them. And as long as an organisation sort of formally agrees to abide by these principles, They can legitimately call themselves another co-op to other co-ops. I think it's worth going through them, and
yes,
I'll
please
be very brief. It's obviously a bit boring to know a list
valuable
of things, but the first one is voluntary and open membership. So anyone who's able to use the services and willing to accept the responsibilities of membership may join, and there's no restriction. Democratic member control. Now, this is the principle that defines cooperatives as against, say, a company owned by shareholders,
yeah,
or a charity owned by its trustees, ultimately in law. Membership, economic participation. That means that the dividends, say, from a trading co-op, such as the cooperative supermarkets that we all know, interest-bearing account or membership with a credit union.
Yeah.
Again, that's redistributing the income. Or the income is also usually partly kept into the organisation to further the organisation, of course, and it's obviously decided, in theory, by the whole membership, because the whole membership is allowed to come to the annual general meeting or other general meetings of the you know, the smaller group that sort of takes on the day-to-day management in some way. Principle four is autonomy and independence, which I quite like, because cooperatives are different to state organisations and different to co-ops, which are part of sort of small units of a larger company. Each
yeah.
one is fundamentally, in terms of its decision-making and ownership, independent of the others.
Yes.
But now we get to the way that co-ops work together. So the next principle is education, training and information. That's what we're trying to do with Principle 5, hence the name.
Hence the name. Great. Well, it's so important, so valuable that you ran through those.
Yeah,
thanks
sure.
for that.
And so we've got cooperation among cooperatives as Principle 6, and yeah. I think there's an organisation actually called that. And concern for community. So this is Principle 7. Cooperatives are fundamentally not a group of selfish people who get together just for their own interests.
Mm.
Principle 7 is there to say, we're also outward looking and we want to help the planet and its people.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Grand. Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Excellent. So tell me more then about the education and the support, the other ways in which Principle 5 supports cooperatives here in Sheffield.
Okay, well, we just felt that although Sheffield has a really great cooperative development service, Sheffield Cooperative Development Group, that's housed in Hazelwood's Mill, where we're housed, and they do the help, the hand-to-hand, in-hand help for groups who want to set up co-ops or they get into a legal problem or something. That's there, but we thought there's a step before that where the people need to be informed, I mean, to raise awareness of the number of co-ops around them and how much fun people are having who work in co-ops and volunteer with co-ops. It's a fundamentally different and, we think, a lot nicer way to work.
Yes.
So we started collecting books and pamphlets and so on, and Hazelwood's Mill, which is a cooperatively owned, huge, renovated mill, they kindly gave us a reasonable rate for to build up a library and archive there.
Yes.
And then over the last two or three years, we've looked outwards and thought, what can we do? We've had a series of study groups, arranged a couple of talks, and we're working on pamphlets. We've got a nice website, and the archive that we've built up with the help of a great student from Sheffield University, we've had it properly catalogued. So
yes.
That's all also searchable online. And the future's open, really. We've got ideas like having film shows and so on to raise education. We last gave a talk as part of this year's Festival of Debate. We
yeah.
organised something there. A great researcher called Kiri Langmead, who challenged the theory that cooperatives always degenerate. She's done a lot of research into this and proved the opposite, really.
Okay, grand. So a range of resources in terms of library materials, putting on events, participating, research and more. And it leads to a couple of questions, and it's worth asking you these questions because they're questions that might occur to some of our listeners as well. And the first question that people sometimes say to me when I'm talking about different business models is a perception that some folk have that it's difficult in a cooperative to come to a decision if there isn't a leader. Now, what would you say if people were to say that to you about cooperatives. Is that a fair or legitimate concern, or is it actually not the case? Is it a complete and utter misconception?
I think it's a misunderstanding of what leadership is.
Yes.
It's necessary to have leadership within a small group of people, but it might fluctuate from one minute to the next. Somebody might say, I think we should do this. All the others nod, they start doing it. Another person then takes the lead by saying, wait a minute, if we did it in this way. So that's leadership. Does that need to be housed in one person, one fallible human being? I don't think so. And from experience, I work in a tech worker co-op called Web Architects, based here in Sheffield.
Right, yeah.
And after a few months of working there and not having worked in a co-op before, I thought I had to say something about the way things were being run. And I thought, I was pretty nervous about it, really. I'm quite a confident older person, but all of a sudden I thought, well, I didn't want to offend my colleagues. And yet one of my colleagues said, well, yeah, if you think that's right, that's right. We're all in charge here. And it kind of hit me. We are all in charge. And there's no higher authority. And it's very liberating. It really is. And I think a new layer of... You might think, oh, a new layer of responsibility hangs on your shoulders because there's no father figure or whatever to really pull somebody up by the bootstrings or throw somebody out. But that layer of responsibility, it's quite good fun. It's quite empowering. And it means that you've got more trust in your colleagues. Now, should an argument develop, and arguments can rumble on, the cooperative movement has got long experience of techniques that help to break the stalemate in an argument, or obviously, you know, emergency rescue. There is the Cooperatives UK organisation, which offers great help and support resources. Or you can just call on a neighbouring co-op. This is something that doesn't happen in business, I think. One co-op might ask another co-op to come in and perform the services of arbitration between two sides of an argument. So there's ways and means of managing without leaders, and I really would not like to go back to being under a leader.
So this this flat lack of hierarchy, everyone taking responsibility, you've got the direct experience of this in the tech co-op in which you're working and making a living, and you know that these ways and means, as you describe them, these processes can work, and these are well developed processes that Cooperatives UK and other cooperatives can help one another with. That is really interesting. Thanks for that, Jonathan. So you've come into the studio today, and you've brought something with you about a centenary. Tell us more about the centenary that is being celebrated.
Okay, so this is a newspaper called The Sheffield Cooperator, which ran from 1922 to 1939. Right. These were the highlight years of what became the co-op group now, when it was originally Co-op Retail Society and Cooperative Wholesale Society, and dozens and dozens and dozens of smaller co-ops merged together over those years. Eventually, this part of the cooperative movement, it literally owned shipping liners in the days when there weren't so many shipping liners around the world, and it owned huge production facilities in this country and abroad. And then in 1939, something else happened, the war, and the newspaper production stopped. And the cooperative movement, I think it's fair to say, perhaps from the 50s onwards, the cooperative group, rather, declined a bit through to perhaps arguably the 80s. And this newspaper didn't exist. But Principle 5 is now doing a second edition, the first edition of the new revived Sheffield Cooperator newspaper came out earlier this year, edition 171, and we're working now on edition 172, which will be out in a few days from now. It's a newspaper format, so we'll be distributing it freely. If you see a newspaper lying around in the pub or the bookshop or the cafe, pick it up and have a look. You'll be able to get hold of a copy, obviously from us, principal5.coop.
Grand.
That's our website.
And so I imagine there'll be copies available to pick up at places you've mentioned, such as Union Street. There are some well-known cooperative shops in Sheffield as well. So presumably through those. I mean, you could mention some of those if you'd like to.
Yeah, so there's so many, it's hard to know where to start. But if we say, talk about the food supply, for example.
Yeah.
Places like Beanies, Lembas.
Yeah.
These are worker cooperatives. In terms of housing, there's all sorts of housing co-ops, from Sheffield Student Housing Co-op through to long-established places, which are sort of typically two or three houses in a row. Fireside Housing Co-op and Brambles Housing Co-op come to mind.
Yeah.
Huge enterprises like Swan Morton, which is a specialist steel factory, long established. You might know the name from craft knives and so on. That's a type of cooperative which is sort of worker owned.
So Swan Morton, loads of folk might not realise, is worker owned cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm thinking in terms of where people can collect the newspaper when it's out. It's probably most convenient for people to pop into somewhere like Beanies, as you mentioned, or Lembas, which is open to the public in terms of retail venues to collect something, or in the city centre, Union Street, or perhaps Portland Works if they have copies there. But some great examples of co-ops there. We're hearing quite a lot more about traditional businesses considering and taking steps to convert from one ownership structure, a widely used ownership structure, and converting to become worker-owned. So there's been talk of some well-known names converting, and in Sheffield, there have been some big firms convert to worker-owned, or talk about becoming worker-owned. Now, is there a growing public perception interest in co-ops? You said earlier that between, say, 1939 and the 1980s, it was sort of not such a good time for co-ops, but interest has grown massively since the 80s. Are we seeing a resurgence in interest?
Yes, I'm sure that's true. I saw some figures last year, which I can't remember from the top of my head, but every X number of days, a new co-op is formed. It's early enough to see that there is a trend emerging, and one interesting aspect is I think that a lot of the new co-ops are consciously socially involved and progressive, and trying to make a difference rather than merely replicate a supply, which is fine in itself, of say housing or food or so on. But now we're seeing co-ops that are happy to remain small, vibrant, and socially engaged. I should probably say, for example, in the arts sector, Sheffield Creative Guild is a cooperative itself. And there are organisations such as Pedal Ready and Shipshape. Now, these are obviously, Pedal Ready is promoting cycling, and Shipshape promoting general good health. So I think that's an interesting new development among co-ops that are really trying to make a difference in a wider way than simply earning a living.
Indeed, yeah. So making a difference, making a positive difference to society. I mean, I know I've interviewed folk from Pedal Ready quite a long time ago here on Sheffield Live, but that was absolutely fascinating. Lovely interview. Great. So, Jonathan, where can folk find out more about the tech cooperative that you're part of, and also about Principal 5? Would you like to give website addresses out for us?
Yeah, sure. So I work in Sheffield, in a Sheffield Tech co-op called Web Architects. So it's webarchitects.coop.
Yep.
That's in a larger group of 30 or more tech co-ops around Britain. So we're well linked in, and we particularly help to support open source or free software.
Right, yeah.
And we're very consciously trying to help people to use online services, cloud services and so on, which are very secure and separate from the corporate Google, Facebook and so on. So that's our social aims, as well as actually providing a good, hopefully, a good online web hosting service.
Okay.
So that's Web Architects. And then Principle 5, which is, as I say, helping to raise awareness of co-ops around Sheffield. We are based in Hazelwoods Mill on Nursery Street. Website is principle5.coop, again, C-O-O-P, .coop. And the starting point for people to get involved would be, or people to find out more, would be to look at the website, and there's a phone number there. The office is attended most days of the week, but usually by arrangement, so if a phone call before you actually turn up at the door would be good. We're helping to raise awareness in a number of ways and welcome people who would like to find out more, would like to offer or ask us questions. And in particular, sometime next month we're having a social evening, and we've done this a few times. We're going to have the social evening in the Gardener's Rest, the Sheffield's only cooperatively owned pub, of course.
Grand. So details will appear on the website,
of course,
and that will be sometime in September.
It is, yes. Thanks.
Great. Well, Jonathan, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. And do check out the website to find out more and get involved. Jonathan Cook, thank you.
Lovely. Thanks, Jamie.
This is Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veitch. That was Jonathan Cook of Principle 5 and Web Architects talking about co-ops. Thanks so much, Jonathan, for meeting with me earlier this week to do that. If you've only just tuned in, you missed that. Don't panic. The podcast will be up on the Sheffield Live website from about 11 a.m. today. Now, VAT. If you are puzzled, confounded about VAT, then our next interview is for you. I caught up with Morgan Killick, and he talked all about VAT and addressed some common misconceptions when it comes to VAT for businesses in a recent interview. It was so good that we've played it once a few weeks ago, but we're going to play it again right now.
Okay, so hi Morgan, thanks so much for joining me on the radio show once again today. It's been a little while, hasn't it?
It has been a while, Jamie, indeed. It's lovely to be back.
Great stuff. Well, I wanted to ask you to tell us about VAT. So lots of listeners will know the VAT threshold is £85,000, around £85,000. Is that exact?
It is an exact level, indeed, £85,000, although you can actually register for VAT if your turnover is below that level and you want to do so on a voluntary basis.
You can indeed. Now, I wanted to ask you about that because you're involved with a programme that is helping businesses that are approaching the VAT threshold and they don't necessarily know what to do and what they have to do and how to surpass the threshold, how to get registered, how to make sure they're compliant, but how to continue to run healthy, thriving businesses. I know from talking to lots of folk running small businesses, there's a lot of confusion about VAT. So what's the programme you're running? How did it come to be and what does it aim to do?
Yeah, that's right, Jamie. VAT is a really unusual tax because in a way you're acting as a tax collector on behalf of the government. So the government is expecting businesses to collect taxes on its behalf. And that has a big implication on cash flow. And especially if you've been used to running your business by looking and seeing how much money's in the bank. This is one of the things that you tend to do as a small business. But as you get bigger, particularly as you approach the VAT threshold and when you are registered for VAT, you can't judge your business like that anymore because at the end of each quarter, you've got to give 20% of that to the VAT man. So the context here is that Sheffield does underperform in terms of the number of VAT registrations per capita. In other words, there are less businesses here that either get to that £85,000 worth of turnover, or who for some reason want to hold back from growing beyond that level of turnover.
Right, that's really interesting context. So Sheffield underperforms in comparison with other cities on a per capita basis.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. So if you look at other cities, there are typically more VAT-registered businesses in those cities relative to the population of the cities than there are in Sheffield.
Okay, so, and do we know why that is? Why Sheffield underperforms?
I'm not sure that we do exactly know why that is. There is, as you know, and you probably reported on your show before, you know, quite a thriving economy of freelancers and consultants and micro businesses in the city. It's a great place to start a city. But perhaps there's something there about businesses not wanting to grow. Maybe is there an ambition problem? I don't know. I'll kind of leave that hanging.
That's a good question. So is there an ambition problem, or is it more that people are scared? They're scared of moving beyond, going from, if a business is turning over perhaps 50, 60, 70,000, they know the threshold figure is 85,000, and they think it's going to create a huge amount of extra work and extra cost, and they're terrified of going over that. Is that the case, do you think? And are people scared?
Yes, I mean, scared might be too big a word for it, but I think there's definitely something there about tempering the growth of your company because you're concerned that there's this barrier ahead. It almost acts, I think barrier is a good word, actually. I mean, I've met companies and talked to companies who seem to be doing well, and I say to them, you know, well, you can't be long then before you're registering for VAT. Ah, no, we're trying to keep it a little bit below the VAT threshold here. Because we don't want the extra admin, we don't want the extra financial systems to be in place, and we don't want to have to put our prices up. It's obviously that's a key thing.
Yes.
And really, that's why the program is there. It's there to support those businesses that are approaching that 85,000 turnover, and to help them A, understand the VAT system and implement it correctly. Because you can go horribly wrong if you get it wrong. But it's actually quite an easy system when you get it right.
Yeah.
So that's the programme is there for that reason. And also, on the programme, you get provided with one-to-one growth advice and mentoring from myself and some of the other people that are involved in delivering the programme to help you grow your ambitions. The idea is you don't just approach the threshold and it's all business as usual. You bust through the threshold.
Okay.
You grow your company bigger than that 85,000, and when you look back, you just think that was one of the milestones you hit on your way to your successful business.
Right, grand. So let's remind folk, first of all, then, your credentials. You've set up, launched, run and grown enterprises, social enterprises, businesses and so on, and you've worked now as a high growth advisor to numerous businesses too. So can you just, in a sort of the 1 minute, 2 minutes perhaps, summary of why your experience is relevant to this program?
Yeah, sure. So 20 years ago, it is now, pretty much. I was thinking about it this morning. It's 2018 now, but it's about 98 that I first started a business. And I started it in my bedroom, like a lot of people. I was very grateful to find my first few pieces of work. And, you know, roll on another 10 years or so, and that business is employing 10 or 15 people.
Yeah.
It's got £500,000 turnover. We have our own offices. And then roll on a little bit further again. I'd got it to the point where I was confident that really I had the right management team in place to run the company for me, and I was able to take a step back from it.
Yes.
That company is still growing today. It's an IT services company. Very much so. I had the full gamut of experience from a blank sheet of paper, if you like, right the way through to employing 20, 30 people, dealing with hundreds of thousands of pounds going through the bank every day.
Yes.
All that comes with it, really. So because of that experience, I felt like I was in a good position to advise others. And in fact, towards the end of my involvement with that particular company, I was approached quite a lot for advice and support on an informal basis.
Yes.
So when it came to thinking, well, what am I going to do now? I've got all this free time. I naturally wanted to do something for the city, and I naturally wanted to do something that was about continuing my support and input into other businesses with growth ambition and potential. And I was lucky enough to get involved with Business Sheffield, who recruited me as a high growth business advisor. And other bodies in the city, Sheffield Hallam University and Groundwork and a few others as well. And they essentially bring me in as a consultant to help talk to those businesses, the people that own and control and manage those businesses, in a way that they'll understand. And to somebody who has genuinely been there and done it and got the T-shirt.
Great.
So that's my role and experience in a nutshell.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. And it's really always really helpful to know that someone has been through the challenges that they're advising about.
Indeed.
As well. So you talked earlier on about a couple of conceptions, potentially misconceptions, when it comes to VAT as well. And you talked about the idea of collecting the money and having to charge extra prices as a result. Now, I've heard a lot of people talk about, you know, if they're VAT registered, they have to charge extra prices, and that might mean that they lose customers. Now, if someone were to come to you and talk about that concern, what would you say to them?
What would I say to them? Very good. Well, I mean, I think there's two things there. One is that for a lot of businesses, if you're serving the business community, yes, okay, when you become VAT registered, you might have to put 20%, well, you do have to put 20% or other rates may apply on your products and services. But it's likely that the business community is also VAT registered and will be able to claim that VAT back. So it doesn't actually make any difference at all for most B2B type businesses.
Yes.
In a B2C environment, so that's where you're selling directly to a customer, yes, putting prices up is inevitable. However, what I would encourage that kind of business to do is to think about growth and think about profitability and think about perhaps splitting that price rise, perhaps partly passing it on to the customer and partly taking a short-term hit on the cash flow in exchange for greater growth potential and profitability in future. Also, of course, they can claim back some VAT, and that's one of the nicest things. I remember when I first registered for it with my company, and my accountant said to me, well, you do realise that most businesses that first register for that actually end up making a bit of money out of it, don't you? And I was like, no, I didn't realise that. I'm delighted that my first VAT return, I can't remember the exact figure, but it brought £3,000 or £4,000 into the
yes.
company at a time when cash flow was very tight.
Yes.
So being able to claim back on prior expenses that you've incurred in setting up the company or in growing it is also kind of a big bonus in the short term and helps you overcome that hit on the bottom line that you might have to incur at first.
Yes.
So there is some good news in the VAT system as well.
Great. And again, a lot of people might not be aware of that. So if your financial year is, say, starts of April to the end of March, for example, and you register for VAT in September, does that mean that you're able to claim VAT back on purchases made before registering? How does that work?
Indeed, you can claim purchases back from before you register for VAT, in some cases quite a long time, in some cases many years before you register for VAT.
And again, I think a lot of people don't actually know that.
No, that's right. And, you know, it's great. I mean, part of what we go through on the VAT Breakthrough Sheffield programme, there's a website, by the way, www.vatbreakthroughsheffield.org.uk. Part of what we go through in that is not just giving you the information in a business context in terms of, you know, contextualizing it. It's not theory, it's about how it applies in your business, but we give you one-to-one support to look into your own individual case.
Yes.
To look at what you can claim back,
right?
Because the program is co-delivered by chartered accountants.
Yeah.
Who can actually look at that for you.
So the programme, and we'll give out the website again in a few minutes so that people can check it out, register and so on, co-delivered, you're involved, chartered accountants are involved.
Indeed.
Business Sheffield.
Business Sheffield are providing the service. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And so is this free to access for businesses, or is there a registration fee, a payment? How does it work?
No, it's a completely free program. You register through the website.
Yeah.
The program manager will be in contact with you just to check it does apply to your circumstances. Yes. It's only for Sheffield-based businesses,
yeah,
I'm afraid. Okay. Registration is free. So we have workshops in the city centre at Business Sheffield coming up in October, December, I think. There's also one at the Union Street co-working space in September. And as well as the opportunity to attend those half-day workshops where there is even a free lunch. There is such a thing as a free lunch on this programme.
Wow. Now, that's something you don't get very often.
That's indeed. As well as that, you also get that one-to-one advice from accountants or a growth expert like myself that will help you bust through that threshold.
Grand, super. Okay, and we will give out the website once again in a few minutes. But a couple of other perceptions around that I'd like to ask you about, if I can, Morgan. On this show in the past, we've had one guest talk about the idea that lowering the VAT threshold, which has been something that reportedly the government has considered doing, lowering the VAT threshold would be good for business because people wouldn't be holding themselves back, in his view, at around the 50,000-60,000 level. And if the threshold was lowered to as low as 30,000 or 40,000, that could inspire people to aim higher than they do. You talked a bit about people. Well, we talked about whether the word scared was an appropriate word or not, but we talked about whether people hold themselves back at around the 50,000-70,000 threshold. Do you think the threshold is likely to come down? I mean, it's very hard to sort of predict the future when it comes to government policy anyway. And do you think if the threshold did come down, it would be good for business?
Well, that's a big question, putting me on the spot there. Thank you for that, Jamie. I think it's certainly more likely to come down than it is to go up. Mm-hmm. I think the government see it as a handy way of collecting taxes without having to put income tax, which is obviously politically, a very tricky fish to deal with. Whether it would make whether it would create that aspirational thing, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I guess it remains to be seen. I suppose one thing it would do is create quite a lot more costs for end consumers at that range. So you think about small tradespeople that you might work with, getting building work done on your house or whatever. That's going to put the price of that up. So it might have an inflationary effect. I guess that would be something that I would be a little bit worried about. But I guess if we're going to inspire businesses to grow, there might be slightly better ways of doing it than perhaps bringing the threshold down a long way. I think certainly over the next couple of years, it's likely to come down perhaps to 80, 75.
Yes.
It nudging it down, I think, is something that may well happen.
It might well be nudged down, and that would, in any case, create a big impact for the Chancellor in terms of collection. As you say, it's politically very difficult for governments to put up income tax if they've said they won't anyway.
Yeah.
And the government has already had a look at the self-employed with... There was a lot of talk earlier on this year, last year, about self-employed paying less taxes than business people because of different rates of national insurance and not having to pay NI. And the government was accused by IPSI, the organisation for professional self-employed, of sort of forgetting about the fact that people who are self-employed don't get sick pay, often have very poor pension provision and so on and so forth. And in effect, the government sort of U-turned on the idea of trying to collect higher taxes from the self-employed. So as you say, potentially, and neither you or I are going to setting ourselves up as pundits here, but potentially the VAT threshold could be lowered.
I think targeting the self-employed is a mistake at the end of the day, isn't it? As you say, self-employed people have, you know, it's great in terms of the freedom it gives you, and, you know, the ability to be your own boss is just one of those kind of life-affirming, you know, self-realizing goals for a lot of people. And I think we should encourage that. But also we've got to remember that a lot of self-employed people are, you know, only just making ends meet. And I think passing tax increases on to them when they don't have the benefits of employment, job security, pensions, other perks, was a mistake, and I'm glad that they changed their minds on that. I think one thing on the tax front that is coming, and small businesses will probably be aware of it, but corporation tax is forecast to come down over the next few years, yeah. Or is intended to come down. Whether that will happen or not, who knows? I think a lot of it will depend on what happens with Brexit. But at the same time, taxes on dividends are going up.
Yes.
So obviously I've run limited companies for many years, and gradually some of the perks at the lower end of profitability have been eroded.
Yes.
So, for example, there used to be a £10,000 tax-free allowance on a limited company, which I thought was a really, really good encouragement for those self-employed to move towards becoming limited.
Yep.
And that was abolished. There was also, you used to get some form of credits for your dividends, and that effectively meant you didn't pay much tax on the first part, 20 grand, whatever it was, 30 grand of your dividend. Those have also gone now, and that's been eroded. And I understand what the government's saying. They're trying to equalise the taxation rates between those who are employed and those who run limited companies. But again, I think the same argument applies with self-employed. These are risk-taking people.
Yes.
And if they pull off that risk, they're going to employ more people. So why penalise them? I don't know. It doesn't quite make sense, that, to me.
No, indeed. Okay. Now, that's really interesting. Let's go back then to a couple of other VAT perceptions and give people some advice around VAT. And first of all, it's a flippant one, but it's an important one. Food. Jaffa cakes. VAT. Able or not. There's a massive debate about this because of how VAT applies to food. So perhaps you can tell us about putting VAT on food, because there's loads of confusion here.
There is a lot of confusion, and I'm laughing too, because the first draft of our flyer to promote the VAT breakthrough Sheffield programme was going to be a Jaffa cake.
Oh, was it? Oh, right. A Jaffa cake. I didn't know that.
On the front. And then we wondered whether everyone would remember that or not.
Yeah.
But no, certainly, you know, the difference between taxing a cake and a biscuit is something that is lost on most people. And you know, why would they know? Food is particularly a tricky area. There is a difference. I mean, I'm not going to get into the details of how it works, because even I don't know. That's a job for an accountant, that one. And that's why we've got accountants on the programme, to literally tell you, go through every single product and service that you sell and determine what rate of VAT applies. I believe in food, there's a difference between hot food and cold food. And there's that, again, a famous case with the pasty.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And this was allegedly an HMRC inspector standing outside a pasty shop in Cornwall asking people whether they were eating hot or cold pasties in order to do some kind of VAT inspection on the business. Look, you know, the main thing is it's complex. What's complex about VAT is knowing which rates apply to which different thing.
Yep.
That's the complexity, really. The actual overall system is not that complex. And, you know, once you've got it in place, the right reporting, it's fairly straightforward. But that level of complexity and detail about what does and doesn't apply will be gone through with an accountant on our programme. That's the main thing, so that you can be sure that you're applying the correct rates.
Okay, grand. Excellent. And I've heard anecdotally accountants and other business advisors talk about HMRC looking and scrutinising businesses that are turning over somewhere between £65,000 and £80,000, and looking at the business owner and seeing if they're setting up a second entity, and taking a dim view if people are, because they think they're doing that to avoid VAT. So if someone's turnover is around that mark and then they create another business which might be entirely different, or it might and it might be entirely justifiable for another business, but HMRC might think you're doing it, so you have two things to trade through to avoid VAT. Is that the case, do you think? And are people actually doing doing tactical measures like that to avoid this?
No, it's very true. I mean, this does happen. I remember once talking to a builder who came to do some work for a colleague of mine, and my colleague was querying why, you know, such an apparently large company, there was no VAT to pay on the job. It wouldn't have made any difference to them because they were a business. This chap explained that he had 17 different companies. One to do the paving, one to do the bricklaying, one to do the roof, one to do the windows, and you know, I mean, essentially, this is quite a long time ago now, but the HMRC have been cracking down on this. Clearly, they are all construction. It's the same guy that owned it all, and he may have been able to get away with that for a while, but I think these days that they're a lot more savvy to that.
Yes.
And I think what I'd say to that business that's thinking of doing that, just kind of, you know, artificial, what we're talking about is artificiality.
Yes.
And I'm not a legal advisor or an accountant, so I want to be clear, this is an opinion, but I think what they're looking for is, are you artificially creating new entities, new legal entities, new limited companies, in order to avoid your core company going over the VAT threshold?
Yeah.
And what I'd say to that kind of business is, look, you know, if you're growing a business here, Why give yourself the burden of an extra set of accounts, yes, an extra board to deal with, an extra set of dividends to deal with? Just put it all through the one company, but let that company grow and thrive. And things are a lot easier. Sooner or later, you're going to have to pay VAT on all of them, aren't you? So if you keep growing, it's an inevitability anyway. So you know, why dodge it? You don't need to. Come on our program if you want free support on what that involves, how to implement it, and how to grow the company. Do that rather than artificially create a headache for yourself later down the line, and something that HMRC may end up querying.
Yeah, makes absolute sense. Yeah. Okay, super. And so the program is really, as you say, it's about bursting through, breaking through, exceeding the threshold, and all the business benefits that that will give to you. So you get access to you get access to accountants, you get access to workshops and so on. Free, you need to register. Can you give out the website address for us again?
Sure,
Morgan?
Yeah. So this is for Sheffield-based businesses only, and it's www.vatbreakthroughsheffield.org.uk. We're particularly focusing efforts on companies that were created within the last 2 years. However, it's welcome for everybody to apply. And there needs to be a realistic prospect that you're going to... Business Sheffield is keen to focus the support on those that most need it. So there needs to be a realistic prospect that you're going to hit the VAT threshold or grow through, you know, that level of turnover before long.
Okay, grand. So if you're turning over about 20,000-30,000, but you have a business plan that looks really, really credible, with predictions of exceeding and reaching that threshold soon, is the program for you, or do you have to be at sort of the 50,000-60,000 level?
We don't want to put numbers on it, because as you know, Jamie, you might be involved in a business that only turns over 20,000 or 30,000. Well, that turns over, I'm not going to say only, that turns over 20,000 or 30,000, but you might be about to crack a big deal that could bring in 50,000 or 60,000.
Yeah.
So putting numbers on it is not something I want to, you know, specify. I think what we're talking about is companies with a realistic prospect of exceeding the 85,000 turnover within, you know, 6 to 12 months.
Well, again, that's really good to hear, because that is absolutely clear in terms of the fact that this program is open and accessible to you if there is a realistic prospect.
Absolutely.
Grand.
Absolutely.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with you on the radio, Morgan. Absolutely fascinating as ever. We can go on, and I'd love to get you back on the show again soon. I think let's just finish with a call to action. Take a look at the programme, register. It can really, really help your business. Of course, you're also working as a high-growth advisor through Business Sheffield. And Business Sheffield has a range of programmes and support that are on offer. We frequently flag up Business Sheffield's free events on this programme as well. But perhaps, again, I can ask you to give out the Business Sheffield website address and any other website addresses that you want to give out as well.
Okay, so the Business Sheffield website address, this is a bit of a test for me, but I think it's welcome to Sheffield. org.uk/businesssheffield, but I'm not entirely sure. most of the clients I meet through that are, of course, high growth businesses that I've met in a networking event, or are specifically being targeted for support because of something that's happened in the investment environment. And that's something I'd like to chip in with, actually, although there's no website corresponding to it. But Business Sheffield is on a bit of a push at the moment in terms of investment in digital and tech businesses in the city.
Yeah.
And again, it's on the back of underperforming. And perhaps I'd like to come back and talk to you a little bit more about the support we can offer to those businesses another time.
Brilliant. Yes, that sounds absolutely great. I mean, I know we've got some incredible tech businesses in the city, and we've had some of them on this show, but as a city as a whole, if underperformance compared with other cities, and Business Sheffield is supporting them, great. Love to talk about that in more depth.
Yeah, and of course we don't mean underperformance of the companies, we're not enough investment. Investors are there going, well, where's the pipeline in Sheffield? Really want to hear about these businesses. And I know, as you said, we've got some fabulous businesses here. And part of my work at Business Sheffield is matching them up and helping them access that investment.
Superb. Well, pleasure to talk with you as ever, Morgan. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us. Do take a look at the websites, and I'll tweet the links from my Twitter account, Jamie Veach, and Sheffield Live will as well. And of course, the links are also in the show notes against the podcast as well. So take a look at the podcast summary page on the website, and you can follow the links through to everything that we've discussed on the show today. Morgan Killick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield. Made by you.